you love it here. By way of self-introduction, my name is Carla Prime. I've been coming to Holden since the late 80s, and as I said in my little bio, it's kind of my heart's home. It's a really important, been an important part of my life in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I've been in ordained ministry since the early 80s, and by way of introduction to this class, I would say when someone asks, why are you teaching this class? Over the years of my ministry, I've tended to focus on things that have met some of my own needs and passions. So in the early 80s, I was very involved in interfaith dialogue because partway through seminary, I found out that my father was Jewish and had been in Europe during the war. So that interfaith dialogue became very important for a number of years. Later on in the 80s, I got very interested in Christian initiation and baptism, and you will all laugh at this, because I thought that as someone who really just started going to church as a college student, I was a late in life convert. So Christian initiation, how people become Christian if they haven't so much grown up with it, although I've been a Christmas and Easter Episcopalian. Not that there are very many Episcopalians like that, but there are some. Then in 1988, there was a large oil spill off the coast of Washington, the Nestucca barge, then the largest oil spill in state history. And I was a priest at St. Mark's Cathedral, and for several days I saw stories in the Seattle Times of pictures of oiled birds. And the question was, who's going to come down to ocean shores to clean birds? And I said, I'm going. And it was like a kind of conversion experience when I said to myself, I'm going to go on church time. This is a part of my ministry. So environmental spirituality and ministry has been an important part of my years. So why midlife spirituality? Well, I'm in it. And I've discovered that there's a phenomenal literature, both in psychology but also in Christian writing, around spirituality and midlife from a Christian perspective. And so this is actually the first time I'm teaching this course. So, and it's been something I've been wanting to do for many years, and I figure if I don't do it now, I'll be out of midlife and into whatever's next. So that's just by way of introduction. I'm really, really glad to see you all here. So God has given us life, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this day. The lens through which that I'm seeing this work will be a variety of things. I'm going to use scripture, I'm going to use poetry, I'm going to use stories from my own life, and I hope from your life, from human experience. The assumption that I'm making about this work, that although I'll be drawing some from both modern and earlier modern psychology, is using some of the themes that we're about at Holden this week, that this midlife passage is all about how we receive the promises of God during this time of our life. In other words, that there are promises that are fulfilled in our life only as we reach later on, that we couldn't have received when we were younger. So that's part of the lens through which I see this, that we are able to receive some of the loving promises of God at this time in our life that when we were younger we were not able to receive. Part of my assumption is the so-called Paschal mystery, the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, our own death and resurrection experiences. How are those very experiences which can be so devastating and seem to drain us of our vitality and our will to live and our joy in life, the very ways in which the grace of God and the power of God working through us brings us to new birth in a variety of ways. So, assumptions. Today's kind of a vast introduction. Tomorrow we're going to focus on grief and loss as an essential part of what it means to get to this point in life. The third day will be focused on gratitude, another essential dimension. Gratitude just gets deeper, doesn't it, the older we get. The fourth class is going to focus on the body. Notice any changes? And how is that being bodily beings created by God as incarnate in flesh, part of our experience of God? Part of the way God reveals God's self to us is through our experience of being in bodies. And then the last class, I take a little bit from Shakespeare, taking on the mystery, that's what we're here for. Take on the mystery, and it just gets deeper and more interesting the older we get. So I'm going to start with two poems from two very different people, both Christian. John O'Donohue, any of you know him? Celtic scholar, just amazing man. And Sue Monk Kidd, excuse me, not she's not first. Joyce Rupp, Roman Catholic nun. So both of these are prayerful memoir moments about what this time in life is about. So from John O'Donohue, for the interim time. When near the end of day, life has drained out of light, and it is too soon for the mind of night to have darkened things. No place looks like itself. Loss of outline makes everything look strangely in between, unsure of what has been or what might come. You are in this time of the interim where everything seems withheld. The path you took to get here has washed out. The way forward is still concealed from you. The old is not old enough to have died away. The new is still too young to be born. You cannot lay claim to anything in this place of dusk. Your eyes are blurred, and there is no mirror. Everyone else has lost sight of your heart, and you can see nowhere to put your trust. You know you have to make your own way through. As far as you can, hold your confidence. Do not allow your confusion to squander this call, which is loosening your roots, which are in false ground, so that you might come free from all you have outgrown. What is being transfigured here is your mind. Hear a little pause on that. And it is difficult and slow to become new. It is difficult, it is slow to become new. The more faithfully you can endure here, the more refined your heart will become for your arrival in the new dawn. John O'Donohue. Sort of laying out the territory and then presenting a vision. Joyce Rupp does it in a very different way. In one of the many books that I've drawn upon, Dear Heart, Come Home. If you buy one book on spirituality and midlife, this is it. Preface. The persistent voice of midlife wooed and wailed, wept and whined, nagged like an endless toothache, seduced like an insistent lover, promised a guide to protect me as I stood at the door of Go Deeper. I heard the ego's howl of resistance, felt the shivers of my false security, but knew there could be no other way. Inward I traveled, down, down, drawn further into the truth than I ever intended to go. As I moved far and deep and long, eerie things long laid hidden jeered at me with shadowy voices. While love I'd never envisioned, wrapped compassionate ribbons round my fearful, anxious heart. Further in I sank to the depths, past all my arrogance and confusion, through all my questions and doubts, beyond all I held to be fact. Finally, I stood before a new door, the hall of oneness and freedom. Uncertain and wary, I slowly opened, discovering a space of welcoming light. I entered the sacred inner room where everything sings of mystery. No longer could I deny or resist the decay of clenching control. And heard the silent gasps surrender. There in that sacred place of myself, love of a lasting kind came forth, embracing me like a long-beloved one come home for the first time. Much that I thought to be me crept to the corners and died. In its place, a being named Peace slipped beside and softly spoke my name. Welcome home. I've been waiting for you. So two very personal reflections on the territory. So someone asked me today, when's midlife? So I see it's not about chronology. There's a pretty big age range in here. So let's get a little help. I can tell a couple. I knew I was in midlife when mothers with small children, and I always thought they looked like me. They started to look like my daughters. It was also midlife when I go downstairs from upstairs and get to downstairs and couldn't remember why I'd gone there. I thought this didn't used to be the case. So anyway, what's midlife?
Can't remember names.
Names, that's a problem. Names. Can't remember. Anyone else?
Well, you describe it, but I call it Teflon brain. Nothing sticks.
Nothing sticks. This is not a pleasant experience. This is a loss. You don't like this. David.
Well, for me, a teacher, it's when you have a student who comes up to you and says, "My grandmother asked me to say hello to you."
Girls you dated in high school are now grandmothers.
No. How many of you have aging parents? How old are your parents? Anyone got parents left? Give me some ages. How old are you?
96.
92. They're not 40 anymore, are they? 96.
94.
Going?
91.
91. 86. 86. New territory. I sort of have a picture of my mother frozen in my head. She's 40. Parents. Aging parents. A friend of mine wrote me, "My only brother died last year. I have no sisters. I feel a loneliness now from the realization that with my parents' death years ago, there's no one who knew me when I was a child. None to help me remember my early years." Here's another one. I went to Michigan last week to see my Sephardic side of the family. All the aunties and uncles on my mom's side are dead. My father's dead. The only elder left in my family is my aunt. Then it's going to be me and my brother and my cousins. Mm-hmm. Welcome midlife. We're the old elders now. Yes, sir.
Finally, I have four grandchildren.
Four grandchildren. Thanks be to God.
Class reunions coming up.
Yeah. Class reunions. Surprises always at those, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes. Lost many good friends.
Lots of friends. Lots of friends. How many people have had friends this year get sick or die? Yeah. Any surprises? Someone who was really healthy? And kaboom? Yeah, I look at my in-laws, Eric's mother and dad, and they've lost almost everybody. So, and the worlds that go with them. A few years back, pension, 401k. What's that in my 30s? I wish I thought a little harder about that. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Children living at a distance.
Children
totally independent.
Yours are totally independent.
Thanks be to God.
Children independent. After Dick, how many of you had children in your houses, say 20 plus years? Yeah. That's a lot of your life. When they're out of the nest, that's a big change. Mine were 9 months apart, and I just had two, but it was still 19 years. Big chunk of my life. Illness of death, friends. Spirituality and prayer life, is that a little different?
Hopefully,
right. Sometimes it can be, and we'll get into this periodically, things which served as foundations for us aren't working anymore. It's just not working. We have to find God anew. We have to discover anew the promises of God. We're on that, some of you were at the Tolkien class. We're on a journey, and the parts that were familiar along the way that told us who we were with God aren't there anymore. Can you do your one about the New York Times?
Oh, I'm a journalist, and I realized a number of years ago that I would never be the editor of the New York Times, but even more importantly, I realized earlier than that I never wanted to be.
So vocation stuff, work stuff, you know, that begins to shift sometime around late 30s, 40s, 50s. Again, it's very different for different people. And it tends to be, midlife, I think, tends to come earlier if you've had a lot of death in your life, if you've had a lot of illness in your own personal life, if there's been physical or sexual abuse in your life, if things that kind of speak, if you've moved a lot, things like that. So, okay. So now I want to play the tech God promised me would work. So this is a song I love that one day when I was feeling particularly sorry for myself, a good friend of mine said, buy this CD and listen to this song. I think she was trying to say, grow up. Okay. So this is a beautiful song that I wanted to play. Let's see if we can hear it.
May I suggest to you, may I suggest this is the best part of your life? May I suggest this time is blessed for you? This time is blessed and shining almost blinding bright. Just turn your head and you'll begin to see the thousand reasons that were just beyond your sight. The reasons why I suggest to you, why I suggest this is the best part of your life. There is a world that's been addressed to you, addressed to you, intended only for your eyes. A secret world, a treasure chest to you, of private scenes and brilliant dreams that mesmerize. A tender lover's smile, a tiny baby's hands, the million stars that fill the turning sky at night. Oh, I suggest, yes, I suggest to you, yes, I suggest this is the best part of your life. There is a hope that's been expressed in you, the hope of 7 generations, maybe more. This is the faith that they invest in you. It's that you'll do one better than was done before. Inside you know what's yours to finally set right. And I suggest to you, and I suggest this is the best part of your life. This is a song, comes from the west to you. Comes from the west, comes from the slowly setting sun. This is a song with a request of you to see how very short the endless days will run. And when the dark descends, we give anything for one more hour.
Growing old is bad. Getting older is bad. Slowing down physically is bad. Slowing down mentally is bad. It's something to be afraid of. And the perspective that I was just talking to someone before the beginning of this class, and she said, life just keeps getting better. Does that mean that as we get into midlife and older, that only good things happen to us?
No.
But it does mean something about the lens through which we see. And I think the life of faith is a huge part of that. one of the things that I'll get into at some point is talking about from whom do we learn how to grow older? For some of it's our parents, aunts, uncles, mentors, teachers. Some of the people around this village. How many of you learned how to be when you were 20, 40 from some of the people at Holden? When you were 40, 60, or 70? How many of you saw wonderful models here at Holden? Because often we don't know how to do it, but we see it lived in other people. And are they people who have no suffering in their life? It's something inside them. It's the power of God making all things new in them. So that is one of the assumptions. So a little bit of psychology here. Many authors, this passage in life, and it's called midlife, middle age, middle years, middle passage, Daniel Levinson, the age divide, Gail Sheehy, passage into the age of integrity. William Bridges talks about the earlier part of life. He wrote that book, Transitions, that real classic, that the earlier part of our life is called the householder production-oriented part of our life, where we're at work, raising children. Mouths don't work. It's actually busy to get excited. And later, focus basically on the external, making of ourselves somebody, and raising children for many people. And that the next phase of life is called the forest dweller. That isn't that an evocative, forest dwellers, where we really become, in some sense, the shamans, those persons and primal cultures that lived apart from the community and brought wisdom from the earth and from the unseen realms. So from householder to forest dweller, I love that. Eric Erickson describes this part of life that the central the psychological and spiritual struggle of midlife is, ready? The tension between generativity and stagnation. That's interesting. Generativity and stagnation, and that the work is the tension between those and what we do with that in our life. One can say that about many periods of life, but it's particularly true of this. And one of the things Eric talked about is that the way isn't easy and it's not supposed to be. It's not supposed to be. But way before any of these modern and contemporary thinkers, Dante's famous quote, probably some of you can quote it, it's quoted so often. Midway through this life we are bound upon, I woke up to find myself in dark wood, where the right road was wholly lost and gone. It is so bitter it goes nigh to death. The dark wood. And many, many wonderful commentaries on his work. Here. Carl Jung, some great quotes from him. He talked about the morning of life and the afternoon and evening of life. Jung, we cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. M-O-R-N. We cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning will be little in the evening. And what in the morning was true will have become a lie. That's pretty heavy stuff. Does that ring true to any of you?
Oh, yeah.
All right, somebody tell me why. So, anyone?
All the things you thought you knew when you were younger can usually be stripped away through life's experiences.
Yeah.
And you find a whole new paradigm to see the world through.
Yeah. Thank you. Stuff gets stripped out, but at one point we're certain. Anyone else like that quote? Great quote. What was you? And to see it, you can't do it. You can't live the morning. You can't live the afternoon of life according to the program. Jung also said that the earlier part of life is developing the ego, and the second half is basically developing the whole self, what we might call the fullness of self, wholeness, living in Christ. Jung says the midlife transition between these two, between morning and afternoon, he likened to a difficult birth because it involves a breakdown of our old spiritual and psychological structures. And this is a great quote of his. Without such upheaval, we would likely go on as always. That nails me. Without such upheaval, we would likely go on as always. How often in your life have you wanted to keep things the way they were? If they were comfortable. How many times in our lives have we sacrificed growth for security? It felt safe. You know, oh boy, I think I'm going to take this job. I just feel so comfortable there. And then something was calling me to this, but it's scary. It's really scary. Especially as you get older and you start dropping words and forgetting stuff, it gets harder and harder to take those risks. So Jung has another great quote in the end of Jung here. He says, not everyone makes the transition to the second half of life. He said, those who escape or avoid the transition, and this sounds antiquated, but it's kind of funny. Those who escape or avoid the transition are hypochondriacs, niggards, doctrinaires, applauders of the past, or eternal adolescents.
There's some of you know that word, the term puer eternus or Peter Pan syndrome. Some of you know people in their 40s that haven't changed as much, 60s, that have not, they've not done their work, they've not changed. And what are they like? What's a 60-year-old who's still wanting to be 30?
Boring?
Are they happy?
Generally not.
Why aren't they happy?
Because they're not experiencing anything new. They're not being fulfilled. They're finding the life that they've always known is just that. There's no challenge. There's no learning.
Yes?
It's closer to death.
Closer to death.
Yeah. You start thinking about that. In your 40s, you realize you're not immortal. You start thinking about that.
And that's the territory we're going to look into tomorrow a lot, is what does it mean to see the end in ways that you couldn't possibly have imagined when you were younger. And is your response to that, wherever it is I think you're going, or is the response, I'm going to stay 30, because it's really scary to look out there. So Jung had that insight. Murray Stein, both in midlife. He's really good too. He's a Jungian, he's also a Presbyterian pastor, a real classic. Midlife, quote, befalls us, we don't ask for it. It tears up our crafted worlds. The psyche explodes and the lava from this eruption forms and reforms the landscape of our psychological lives. So we're going to start going for a few minutes into imagery, because like so much of human experience, story or imagery or music works a lot better than analysis. I've enjoyed playing with the psychology piece, but even the psychologists allude to things that are really basic imagery. So you just heard some very powerful images there. Tears up our crafted world. Explodes, erupts, reforms the landscape. That's all very visual. Another word you hear a lot is liminality from forget which language, meaning threshold. You know, so liminality, you're not here, but you're not yet there. You're on that place in between. Very unstable and very scary. Another image that's used. And here's a great one. Sumac Kid. Now, who read The Secret Life of Bees? You know what she was doing before that? She was doing a lot of other stuff until she went what she called through her transformation in midlife that gave her the courage to say, you know what, I've always wanted to write fiction. Fiction, right. I've always wanted to write. And so this book, When the Heart Waits, is the story of that journey. Another absolutely phenomenal. It's just all.
I just finished that this morning.
Did you?
Yeah, it was in the library.
Right. How'd you like it?
I loved it.
What'd you love about it?
Well, I liked it because it reminded me of what I went through in the past 15 years, because my mother died in 92, and that totally stripped away who I thought I was. And so now here I am, you know, 15 years later, and I feel like, wow, I'm so glad that I'm all put back together again.
Sometimes it takes 15 years.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a wonderful book.
And so it just kind of, it was very you know, it just made you feel really, I can't think of the right word, but it made you feel really good.
Well, often, I mean, part of what I'm hearing is that it made you feel like you weren't alone.
No. Yeah.
Because I think often this is a chapter in life where we can feel really alone. Am I going crazy? Am I ever going to be okay again? Is anyone else going through this? And part of the developmental psychology that's helpful, as well as the spiritual journey work of the Christian churches, this is what's supposed to happen. It's okay. I mean, just as developmentally adolescents go through this, 4 years old, we're supposed to do this. And a book that really talks about the territory is really helpful. So one of the images that she used, she talked about getting into sketching. She hadn't done that before, charcoal drawing. The previous evening, I'd drawn a tent in the middle of some wind-howling woods. The stakes that secured the bottom of the tent were uprooted, and the flaps were flailing in the wind. As I put down my pencil, I said to myself, "That's my life." Indeed, it seemed as if the stakes that had secured my neat, safe existence, stakes that I had spent most of my life carefully nailing down, had been pulled up, and everything was tossing about. Dude. Underneath the sketch, I wrote, "Midlife." So there's a couple images for you. Volcano, tent flapping in the breeze, wandering in the desert, wilderness, floating. Think Jonah. Uncharted territory. Here there be dragons. Or look what's contained in an expression like, "I feel like I'm a teenager again." There's an image for you that this time of life can remind us of other times in your life where, who am I? Who am I? Where am I going? What am I standing on? Give me something solid that I can stand on. Give me something solid that I can stand on. So, image of a tent. So, shifting a little bit, so far we've been talking about what it feels like, some of the challenges of it, the unsettledness of it. So this, where I'm shifting now is the choices that we have. The choices that we have to go forward, how we're going to go forward. Because it usually is somewhere around midlife where you realize it's not your parents' fault. You know, if you hear someone who's 67 years old, still whining about their mother, it's really not very impressive. You know, we've all got wounds. We've got tremendous wounds. You know, the expression, our parents, the problem with them is they had parents. We've got wounds. But at a certain point, sometime in midlife, you realize, I'm the maker of this next part of my life with the grace of God. I have some choices that I can make, and how I make those choices with God's help are going to set the course. My guess is that at some point after your mother's death, after the tent flaps were flapping enough, you started to decide, you know, I think I'm going to try this, or I think I'm going to try that, because I don't want to stay here. You know, have you ever had the experience in your life where you said, you know, I don't want to stay here anymore, you know, wherever it is that you're stuck?
I choose to not be a victim anymore.
I choose not to be a victim. Thank you.
I don't even like being with me right now.
Yes! David White, and he's a wonderful Welsh poet. He has a great line. Arrange to get really bored with yourself. Of course, he says it with his wonderful line.
Arrange to get bored.
But, you know, if you ever get kind of bored of whatever that stuck place you are, and you say, I don't want to stay here. I don't want to stay here. So where the journey as people of faith is, we heard a little bit from Terry Fredheim this morning in Old Testament, that there's a relationship here. That there's a relationship that as much as we are sort of eager to move on, there's someone over there that's reaching out to us, that's part of this conversation, this relationship of friendship and love and God as parent, God as friend, God as the one with whom we engage. And with that help, with God's help, we are ready to move forward. And here's another great little thing from Sumo Kid. This is really a prayer, because that's how we go forward, with God's help. So in one of the darker points of her life, She opened her journal, and by the spill of light from the porch, the moon, the stars, a prayer, a night prayer of both darkness and pain came roaring out of my heart. I wrote it down, hardly knowing what I was about to unleash in my life. Mm-hmm. So here's the prayer. God, I don't want to live falsely in self-imposed prisons and fixed, comfortable patterns that confine my soul and diminish the truth in me. So much of me has gone underground. I want to let my soul out. I want to be free to risk what's true, to be myself. Set free the daring in me, the willingness to go within, to see the self lying. I'll try to run away, but don't let me. Oh, isn't that beautiful? Great, great prayer. I'll try to run away, but don't let me. Don't let me stifle myself with prudence that binds the creative revisioning of my life and the journey toward wholeness. Here we go. I'm scared, God. Make me brave. Lead me into the enormous spaces of becoming. Help me cease the small, tedious work of maintaining and protecting so that I can break the masks that obscure your face, shining in the night of my own heart. Help me to green my soul and risk becoming the person you've created me to be. Congrats. Tomorrow I may regret these words. But tonight I speak them, for I know that you are somewhere inside them, that you love me and won't leave me alone in their echo. I shut my journal. So there's a prayer, there's a very old prayer from the really old prayer book in the Episcopal Church called the Prayer of Humble Access. This is a prayer of humble access. This is a prayer of self-offering. This is a prayer of putting yourself on the altar, putting your heart on the altar, and knowing from whence your help is to come. It's just a beautiful prayer. So, great word in the, a story. Did a funeral a few years back. Wonderful man in his 70s, and, late 70s, early 80s, who'd had just a remarkably generative last 20 years of his life. And I was taught, I didn't know him that well, and I wanted to get to know him better, but the little I knew about him, I really respected him. So I asked one of his kids about my age. I said, tell me about your dad and me, all these things that did, the causes he was devoted to, and the creativity, and the carpentry. He told us when he was in his 50s, he was getting ready to grow old right. That's kind of a remarkable story. He was getting ready to grow old right. And he, as a 50-some-year-old, had said this to his kids. That's sort of a remarkable old story. We have kind of a choice as to how we want to move forward. So, one of the words we're all familiar with is the notion of repentance. So repentance, that in many good sermons have been preached about, repentance is not only a turning away from, but a turning toward. That Lent, for example, is not just about giving up things, but taking on new things. So one might use that sense of repentance as a way of thinking about how is it that I want to get ready to grow old. Whatever old is. How do I want to move forward in my life in a conscious way? So another story from a woman actually in a class in a book I read. I took a class on midlife. And then she said this, when one day in midlife one comes to doubt oneself and all one's relationships and commitments, and when the pain and anxiety of this dragging away of energy from all that was formerly so life-giving begins to overwhelm, there surfaces the depth question, why bother? Lucky the one who lets that question stand. That question is a prayer. Why bother? That sounds like a very nihilistic, negative, godless, depressed thing to say. But it also comes from a place that often we can find ourselves in, just because of some of the things we talked about earlier. Some of the stuff that motivated you. Some of the stuff that gave you your sense of identity. Some of the sense that gave you the energy to do whatever it was that you, your projects in life. It either isn't there for you to do anymore, or it no longer satisfies you. It no longer gives you that sense of, boy, this is who I am, this makes me feel good about myself. And so the question, why bother? Lucky the one who asks that, that question is a prayer. So how do we sort of stand in that place of repentance, where we realize we're turning from certain ways and turning toward, and ask with God's help that we move forward? So a few things on selves. One of the things that Sue Monk Kidd does very well is she is able to put funny names to parts of herself that she was ready to let go of. One was called Little Red Hen. What's the Little Red Hen? This will probably appeal to women more than men, though. What's the Little Red Hen? Huh?
She does all the work.
She does all the work.
And then eats it all herself.
Exactly.
Little Red Hen.
She was ready to go let go of Little Red Hen. That had been a big part of who she was. Rapunzel. She was ready to let go of Rapunzel. Who was Rapunzel in her life? Who was that part of herself?
Being a victim, or?
Being a victim. Help me, help me, help me. Yeah, she'd spent a lot of her life being help me, help me, help me. Can't do it. Someone come help me. The performer. The good little girl. She said, some of these roles begin to lose their music. So guys, give me some of those stories or some of those images in your life. Those are a lot of very feminine images and roles. What about you? You seem to have people, but is there parts of self you could give a name to?
The hero.
The hero, thank you. Can the guys relate with that? What's the hero?
I can do anything. I can fix it all by my own hand. Look at me. I'm wonderful.
Help me, help me, help me.
Help me, help me, help me.
And there are plenty of women that will play that game. So the hero, the hero.
The judger.
The judger. What's the judger?
I'm right and everybody else is wrong.
Yeah.
They're stupid because they don't know it.
Other ones.
Provider.
Provider. And that probably holds for men and for women. And again, be I'm not saying these are bad. There are many ways in which each of these have been ways in their own way to love and serve the Lord. There's a good example of how. But can you say a little more about when it's time to loosen up a little of that and see what other territory there is in yourself? Can you say anything about that?
Let someone else in to share the vision or cooperate or collaborate rather than having it be a one-way process.
Give someone else the opportunity. And see, over what am I being asked to surrender? And what then can get freed up in you when that part doesn't have to overfunction, doesn't have to hold so central a role? Can you perhaps share something, some part of you that you've discovered when that provider got to take a nap for a while?
That I could do it just as well or provide a different point of view or just contribute.
Yeah. Contribute. And I think on this list, that's another thing I've seen in roughly the mid point of life, is often people who've been very busy being, you know, providing for families and kids and whatever, often those that have not been particularly active in community and in the wider sphere become activists because all of a sudden they're not tending to their kids so much. They find causes that they're very excited about that they really did. And I particularly see there's so many couples raising kids now where both of them are working. They're both working 40, 50, 60 hours a week. The ability for some of these young adults with children to really have much of a meaningful volunteer life is very difficult. Very, very difficult. Some of those young adults, when they get to their 40s and 50s, they're going to have some opportunity, my guess, is to get involved in community in ways that they haven't been able to, as they've been completely working on providing. So some of the places, and we'll talk a little more about this tomorrow, some of these many selves, so we were just talking for a moment about some of these personas and some of these selves that have needed to be center stage that we are willing to at least examine, if not wonder if there is room to move them. And the flip side of that is that they're undiscovered selves that have been on hold for a long time. You know, they may be parts of ourself that were coming to bud when we were 12 or 16 or 21. And then we had to get a job. So we had to do other things. I remember when I hit 40, I went on a friend of mine had all her best women friends over for a weekend. My kids were somewhere I could go. And at the end of a weekend with women, she said, you know, I've got this little Arab horse. Would you like to ride it? I hadn't ridden since I was very young. So I rode this beautiful white Arab horse on the beach in Oregon. And I said, I'm getting back into riding. So I've been riding ever since. So sometimes there are parts of ourselves that are full of life for us, that other periods in our life we've kind of put down, that still have life for us. Any of you have an example? I mean, what's your Arab horse on the beach story? Something that you went back to later in life that you could have, that you were able to go back to, that had given you life in another period that you put aside. Anyone else have an Arab horse story? Yeah?
Knitting.
Knitting.
I learned to knit, like, I don't know, as a Girl Scout or somewhere along the line when I was a teen. And then I was in a house fire and received a prayer shawl, so I wanted to knit one in return. And so I started knitting, and I knit like 14 scarves. And I just loved it. I gave them to all my family who live in Minnesota and need them because it's cold there. And then I did a prayer shawl.
How much did you enjoy that?
I loved it. And I'm still knitting now, so yeah. I just really enjoy it.
Anyone else? Something that you've gone back to later in life that you once loved that you sort of put away?
Being a kid,
like what?
Well, coming from like divorced family, I decided like very young, when I was 3, to be the man of the house. Because I remember some conversation that I told, you know, I'm going away, you have to be the man of the house now. So, but now discovering that being a kid, how much I like being around kids, and discovering that my favorite job that I should have been doing all along is being a school bus driver.
And that other expression you had, that's another one of those, man of the house.
Man of the house.
There's one right there.
And Peter Pan.
Peter Pan, yeah. So discovering how that part of you is alive, mm-hmm. and then you bring all the experience of adulthood into that play.
Mm-hmm.
See how much fun that is. I don't want to be 10 again. I sure don't want to be 20 again. But the gifts that part of me is in here, and yet the experience of all these other years are there. So I can run on the beach mm-hmm. with our 2-year-old granddaughter in ways that I couldn't have when I was 10 running on the beach myself. So thank you. And then other selves, which say weren't there, but we've always wanted to do. Is there something that you've taken up in midlife that you've always wanted to do? Like for a sumo kid writing fiction? And you just decided, I'm going to do it. Any of you have a story about this?
Well, when I was in kindergarten or first grade, there was a couple teachers standing around, and they wanted me to draw a round circle. Well, I couldn't get it right. I could not draw a round circle, and in my day, I was criticized for that. So I went through my whole life feeling inferior. You can't draw. Don't even try. There's no talent there because how well these people are drawing. And then when I was older, I decided not to do musical. I decided to take it up, and lo and behold, I'm not a great artist, but I have some interesting pictures and some life in them. So all those years, I didn't even try. I drew like 3 times, and then all of a sudden, it just opened up.
Oh, beautiful. Did everyone hear that? Yeah. That is so awesome. were told, you can't do that. you really stink at that. And then what'd you say to yourself? Yeah, that's right. I really stink at that. You know? So the opportunity of adulthood is to say, I don't care if I stink at it. I want to do it. And how good does that feel?
Well, it's nice to discover some talent.
It's a great one of her most famous poems. It can be read a lot of ways. That first line, you do not have to be good. We all know that Mary Oliver poem. I'll bring that in at some point. That can be interpreted a lot of ways, but one of the ways, I mean, besides being one of the best first lines of a poem I ever heard, you know, you do not have to be good, but one of the ways you can read that is, you don't have to be a good artist. Draw. Anyone else? Something that you've done that, yeah, Meg.
Well, my father's a wonderful storyteller, and his father was as well, and I just couldn't ever tell stories, and I just couldn't remember them, and I admired that, and recently I went back and got my master's. I'm a teacher in integrating the arts, and one of the classes we took was storytelling, and so I had to get up and tell a story in front of my peers, and I ended up telling that story on the radio.
Did you hear all that? She told it on the radio. Empowerment, you know, what happens when we say, I'm going to try this. Anyone else? Story of something you've taken up relatively later in life that you always wanted to do. Okay, what's one thing you haven't done that you hope to do? Let someone get real vulnerable. Okay. What is it that you hope to do in the next few years and you haven't done it yet? Write a book. What do you want to write a book about? Lots of different things. Okay. Okay. Those people you walk with, you should have a little blessing. Episcopalian, we're so new. We'll turn a ritual. Anything will turn into a ritual. Yes, you. Some of you.
I've been a teacher for many years. So I want writing children's books.
Writing children's books. Okay. Some of you are familiar with the Myers-Briggs personality profiles. You're familiar. There's sort of favored ways of doing things, and then there's the part that's the uncomfortable part, and often growth comes when we try something that's really very difficult for us. I was on a kind of a vision quest retreat once, and off in the wilderness for a few days with a tent and some rope, and I'd learned how to do, it's a very long story that had a really good ending, but I learned, I was very nervous about not having a tent, but I had a tarp and a sleeping bag. But I was really nervous about not being able to get that tarp up. I got the tarp up, and you know what? I must have taken it down 20 times just to show myself I could do the damn knots. You know, and I thought, what are you doing this for? I mean, granted, you have 5 days by yourself, but still. I thought, part of it was, I've always thought of myself as artistic and words and la-di-da-di-da. I've always said to myself, I'm not good with my hands. I'm not good with my hands. Could do that knot. And I took some pleasure in doing it over and over again and putting that tarp up and taking out. For some of you, that wouldn't be no big deal, would it? Some of you love that kind of thing. You do it well. For me, it was something I couldn't do. And it was very empowering. Finding new parts of self. So we're getting really close to the end here. So I'm going to go to a little area that's going to move us, for those of you that will be there, that are able to come tomorrow and the next one. And it's a phrase that I learned a number of years ago called self-compassion. Self-compassion. And I bet there's nobody in the room that needs a definition for that. Especially those of us church people. We often are very good at having compassion on others, but not very good or practiced or trained in doing it for ourselves. Here's a quote from Joyce Rupp. I mean, one of the things that gets in the way sometimes of the growth we need to do is our wounds, right? But here's a perspective. In praying about my wounds, I've come to believe that the reason these wounds take so long to heal is that I spend more time attacking them than understanding them. In praying about my wounds, I have come to believe that the reason these wounds take so long to heal is that I spend more time attacking them than understanding them. by the time you get to whatever this phase of life is, we are aware of some things that have appealed over very well. They're just there. They're part of who we are.
Part of who you are.
But what is our relationship to them? Are we still attacking them? Has attacking your wounds done any good? Does that help to heal?
No.
Self-compassion. I think that's one of the engines that begins to move us away from stagnation towards generativity, away from living in the flesh, as Paul said, to repentance and toward the transformation that is in place. So the image I will leave you with is the image that a friend of mine came up with called a wisdom trellis. Everyone knows what a trellis is for plants. The image of a plant on a trellis. What is that rule of life or practice of prayer, whatever our devotional practice looks like? Prayer with words and books, prayers with music, prayer with labyrinth, prayer. Janice out there in the gardens, her prayer. That's her prayer. That it is really up to us. What is the structure that we are going to, with God's grace, create for ourselves so that that growth can become possible? So that those wounds, rather than festering, can become, as in Christ, the very place from which our growth goes. How many of you have had the experience where an experience of loss or tragedy or something bad became the source of compassion for someone else or wisdom? That very thing which tore you apart, lost your mother, loss of your childhood. Gotta be the man. You couldn't be 4 or 6. But what did that create within by the grace of God so that it became like a river full of life for others? So I think I'm gonna leave you with those thoughts and one last wonderful quote. This is Catherine Dyckman, Roman Catholic nun in Seattle. This is the first book on midlife from a Christian perspective I ever read, called Chaos and Creation. Chaos or Creation. Spirituality in Midlife, there's the title, you kind of got the book. Chaos or Creation. Roman Catholic, she and a nun, and she was a spiritual director for years, and she, with Pat Carroll, wonderful Jesuit priest and activist in Seattle, wrote this book together. This is sort of an extended quote, so I invite you to kind of, if it feels comfortable, kind of close your eyes and just listen to this story coming from a man that had been very active Catholic, very grounded in that tradition, and came to a place where he had a journey to go on in order to arrive back home, and it wasn't going back the route he'd been in his faith life as a Catholic. And this letter was written to Catholic. Well, there, my friend, are my heresies. Perhaps you see more now why I have no community. Feel no groups of people who are where I am. Oh, I still go to Mass. I still pray with them. I share life with them. But always there is a terrible loneliness in the midst of their celebrating and fellowship and ritual security. All I seem to have left is a firm conviction that life is and is good. All I seem to have left is that life is and is good. That death is an aberration to be lived through. That there are many realms of reflective life ahead. And that my entrance into these realms is through faith and love. Many realms of life ahead. And that my entrance into these realms is through faith and love. So, I am called to stand alone. And even lonely in the face of nothingness, emptiness. There I must reach out in love. There I must reach out in love toward no one known or seen or felt or even believed in reality. And I do as much as I am able. Really, Catherine, as absurd as it sounds, I'm very happy and very much at peace. I'm not afraid. I just feel like all the props have been knocked out, that I'm falling into a void somehow filled with life. Isn't that beautiful? Have a wonderful night's sleep, especially those of you first time at Holden. Sweet dreams. We'll see you tomorrow.